If you had to give a single reason why companies buy software, Jan, what would it be?
You know, of course, it's because of the fancy technology that people fall in love with.
Well, obviously, that is nonsense, Jan. You have one more shot.
Okay, as always, Tim, you are right. So they probably want a return on their purchase.
Yeah, you nailed it. It's the ROI. Welcome to Sales Excellence, your podcast for software, B2B sales and pre-sales. My name is Tim and I'm a solution consultant at Seismic.
And I'm Jan, pre-sales leader with SAP. Welcome to a new episode of our show.
Indeed, I do have one housekeeping section in here for us today. Every listener that is in pre-sales, which I'm assuming is the majority, or at least 50% or more of our listenership, please join us at the pre-sales collective. Maybe you've heard about it already. Jan and myself, we are active in there and joined by around 100 German-speaking guys in the GeoDach channel. If you are German-speaking, please join us there. If you're not German-speaking, definitely still join the pre-sales collective, and there will be dedicated channels for you. Would be awesome to connect and network there with you. So that out of the way, let me introduce today's guest, which is Tom Pisello. Starting out as an engineer in the 90s and occupying various leadership and management positions also in the 2000s. In fact, he also has founded several companies, including the Evolved Selling Institute, which actually Jan and myself were fortunate enough to also be on the show because he has a podcast there as part of that initiative. And he is also chief evangelist of MediaFly. Well, welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tim and Jank, for inviting me.
So first question, did I actually pronounce your last name correctly?
You got it right. Pisello. It's a good Irish name.
Irish. I was about to ask where that
went. No. We're absolutely Sicilian from Palermo. Right. But that's a story for another time. That side of the family, yeah, we won't talk about them in this call.
All right. So as the teaser gave away, we do want to talk about ROI today. And I mean, I couldn't think of a better guest than you because you literally call yourself the ROI guy, which I would guess it's quite a bold title. So how did you come up with that one?
It is. I was given that nickname when I was at Gartner Group, and I sold one of my first companies that I created to Gartner. And my life was dedicated to creating return on investment and total cost of ownership models to help CIOs assess whether the investment that was proposed was going to reap rewards, bottom line impact, top line benefits for the company. And vendors were using it as well to do that financial justification. So the team at Gartner gave me that title as the ROI guy, and it stuck because that became literally the defining element of the majority of my career, 30 years spent on financial justification of investments, and in particular, how to leverage it in sales and marketing.
So that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, both you and I, we met actually as part of a sales training that that you sort of gave for Exactly, who recently purchased one of the MediaFly solutions. And it was also around the ROI, right? So this is how we met. And I thought, okay, this guy clearly knows what he's talking about. So let's have a conversation. So let's maybe start with some of the basics. And I think you, to some extent, already gave maybe the answer. Why is ROI so important in the first place?
Yeah, I think that as we look at the uncertainty that's facing many companies today, it has really elevated the importance of return on investment. Folks' jobs are literally on the line if they make the wrong purchase decision. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways to assure that you're going to get value from a purchase is to do a formal analysis of what is the business value that the solution can deliver? How can it help us save costs or avoid cost? How can it improve productivity and processes? How can it help avoid risk or generate business growth? And how does that compare to the investment and the potential risk of that investment being maybe higher or delayed? and crunch all of those numbers and come up with a business case, a financial justification, and then review that and make sure that the project will deliver financially for the organization. And it's a great way to mitigate the risks on the purchase, to make sure that everyone is on board to understand what are the outcomes that the solution can deliver, what is the investment that's needed, and are we willing to make the right investment to get those outcomes? And it also provides, very importantly, a roadmap to track the outcomes post-deployment, which is becoming more and more important. So there's a pre-sales reason to do kind of ROI analysis, make sure that you're making the right decision, as well as a post-sales analysis, which more and more companies are doing now to assure that the outcomes that they predicted are coming true.
Now, I did want to talk about the challenge of why, well, not really a challenge, but obviously there's providers out there such as Mediafly and also other companies that are providing actually software to assist with an ROI calculation, right? And I was about to challenge you a little bit, okay, well, why couldn't I just use Excel for it, right? But I think one of the reasons you also just gave and what you just said, because you say, okay, we want to not only look at it in pre-sale stages, but we want to also, after deployment, validate whether our initial assumptions were actually correct. And I'm assuming software is also a piece that can assist with that.
Absolutely. No, so it can definitely be used to track value across the lifecycle of an investment or the lifecycle of a sale to a customer to predict what the value is going to be, and then to make sure you manage to the value that's delivered. You know, many organizations that have bought solutions, they're buying them as a service, and you have to justify the renewals to those organizations. So as we look at customer success groups, they are taking a much more forward-thinking role, not just saying, how did we do with adoption? How did we do with usage? But instead now focusing on how much value did we deliver to the organization?
Fair enough. So if I still stay within that software vendor of ROI software, I almost have to calculate an ROI for an ROI solution, right? There's a certain meta element to it.
Yeah. And, you know, you're right in that, you know, the roots of this are financial models, and those could be done in a spreadsheet. What we find is that, let's look at the buy side of the equation. When you're buying a solution, it's a lot of work to put together a financial justification model for that solution. And a lot of times the CFOs within the organizations will require it, or there are now COVID committees within these organizations that require that any purchase that's going to be made, there's two important things. One is make sure you align that investment to a top business objective. Number two, make sure it's got a solid business case with all the I's dotted, T's crossed, so we know what the investment is and what the benefits are going to be. Now, think about yourself as the buyer, the champion that's going to want to make that purchase. Have you ever put together a business case for a solution like that within the company? Likely not. So what we find is that although 95% of the companies require financial justification to get approvals across, and that's moving with today's times, close to 100% of companies need it. The unfortunate fact is that 65% of companies, so two-thirds, don't have the metrics, don't have the models, don't have the tools to put together their own business case. So where do they turn? They turn to the vendor, the solution provider. Now, if you go and you, as a solution provider now, provide a spreadsheet to a company, that's good. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem with spreadsheet-based ROI programs is that spreadsheets are often hard to use. It's hard to get sellers to adopt them. So a lot of times it falls to value engineers or pre-sales consultants to go and do and work with the spreadsheets with the customer. And you just don't scale the program to those 95%, 100 of the companies that need the business case. You're only going to touch maybe 10%, 5% in some organizations that we see. Or you have to scale the pre-sales and the value engineering group to be way bigger than is you're capable of doing. So really, when it comes to exploring software like what we provide and what some others provide in the marketplace, it's about scale. And it's also about data, because one of the things that spreadsheets are not good with is collecting data centrally and then leveraging that data in all the subsequent analyses for insights and advice and benchmarking. So it really is time to mature beyond spreadsheets. I mean, spreadsheets were good in the 90s, but, you know, it's 2021, and we need to advance this to be a real software application that can help you not just calculate the value via an ROI calculator, but really help to manage that value pre and post sales with the customer collaboratively.
So can I kick in here?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Go for it.
Because so I'm listening to you guys and I'm flashed, right? And you don't need to convince me why a real software solution is better than Excel. But what I see in day-to-day business is the number one question from sales to pre-sales is, when can we do a demo? Right? Mm-hmm. But not when can we do an ROI calculation?
True.
So, I mean, getting to that point where you realize, hey, we should better have a software to do all that fancy ROI calculation stuff. Is there not a hurdle before where we need to jump over together with our sales team to basically realize that there could be real benefit thinking and adopting like ROI techniques?
Yeah, you know, it definitely is a fact where customers do not proactively ask for the business case. And we find that although 66% of buyers, according to the Rain Group, say that making a clear business case is essential to winning the business, only 16% of sellers are actually good and provide it to the customer. So we're finding that customers want it. They're not asking for it like they are a demo. And then sellers are not proactively delivering it. So what happens? They go to the COVID committee, they go to the CFO, and the buyer is tasked to put this together on their own, and they struggle with it for months and months. Or maybe they just never provide it, and sure enough, the seller's sitting there wondering why that deal is stalled, right? Or what'll happen on the customer success side is you'll go for a renewal, and you'll report on the typical metrics that you do for renewal today, which is, you know, here's how much you paid in your licenses, here's the adoption, here's the usage, sign up for this again, because look, you've got good usage. And the CFO and the COO of the company are looking at it, the COVID committee is looking at it like, we're going to spend another $2 million on this software a year. Isn't there an alternative? Well, you know, great, the usage is up, but what is it delivering to us? So as a seller or as a pre-sales specialist going in, we've got to understand that customers aren't trained to ask for this. Yet we know they need it to get approval. This is one of those checklist items where if we're being good helpers, if we're helping the buyer make sense of the purchase, which Challenger and Gartner are hitting on big time. They're like, look, the most successful sellers nowadays are not the ones that are going to challenge necessarily. They're the ones that are going to make sense and help. Why? Because buyers are already stressed. So if you're able to help them get the purchase through and make it easier, you're going to earn incredible points and streamline that purchase process where the buyer is very frustrated with it. So we have to proactively say, look, if we're being asked for a demo, which is obvious that the customer has to see what it is they're going to buy. And in fact, we're seeing more and more demo requests and multiple demo requests for all the stakeholders, more stakeholders than ever are wanting to see the solution. And they're wanting more customized demos. They're wanting to almost see pilot, pre-pilot kind of for free. At least in my experience, I'm getting a lot of those requests and building out a lot of environments for customers. At the same time, we have to realize that proactively with the demo request, we should also be having not just a technical track, but a business track with the customer, making sure we're understanding and we'll get into these three different perspectives of value. What's the personal value that the customer is looking to get out of buying the solution? What's the business value, which is the cost savings, productivity improvements, risk avoidance, business growth that they can get? And a third, which is called the organizational value. So we're going to need to work just as hard on the business side with the customer as well as the technical side. And we're going to have to bring up those conversations on the business side because the customer doesn't almost know how to do this, yet they're sitting there with a purchase cycle that's delayed, no decisions being made within their own organization. And we're wondering, hey, we did a great demo. Why isn't this deal moving forward? Well, likely it's because you didn't illuminate the pain enough with the customer so that they know to move from, and you didn't justify the solution and put it together in a good story that they can then take upwards in the organization.
So many things to pick apart here. So the one thought that I just had while you were closing off, I would almost argue that for our own sake, before we go ahead and think about demoing anything, we should be ourselves convinced that for a certain prospect that we're talking to right now, there is a compelling ROI.
I agree.
Because so we don't end up at the end of the road having put a lot of effort in and then realizing, oh, shoot, actually, if we would have just done a rough calculation in the very beginning, we could have realized it doesn't actually match up. It's going to be too costly for too little benefit for that particular prospect.
Yeah, I think two things. You've got to make sure you're aligning to a business objective that's important enough for them to solve, and that right away that there's overwhelming value that, for the use cases that they want to apply the solution to and the challenges they want to solve, that you're really helping to illuminate those challenges and making sure there's good value before you proceed. And how we normally do that is we'll set up the software so that with just a few data points, because the customer isn't going to want to spend a ton of time on discovery or research or going to collect metrics here or there from multiple people. With just a few top-level metrics, could we create a value hypothesis or a pro forma for them, right? And deliver it right along with the demo to say, hey, I prepared this. Look, I know this isn't 100% right, but based on the use cases, we challenges you want to address, the use cases we discussed, the objectives you want to solve for, here's the estimated business value we think we can deliver. And based on the size that we discussed, I estimated an investment. Here's the ROI that we think we can deliver. What do you think about that? Is it in the ballpark or not? Because as you said, you can waste a ton of time on demo after demo after demo and customized demos, which customers are asking for more. So it's more expensive. And without having that value hypothesis, at least top level agreed to, I think you could be spending a lot of extra cycles with a customer that you might be able to weed out earlier. And that's good for both parties, right? Good for the customer because they realize that, hey, this may not be worth addressing, or I don't have my ducks in a row yet. Let me go and do that work. And for you as a precious resource within the organization that's going to be doing these demos and helping the seller kind of close it, man, what better way to know that it's a good deal than do that pro forma, do that value hypothesis.
So based on what you just said, Tom, my question would be very simple, right? So how can we increase these 16%?
Yeah, that's it's a challenge that I've been trying to address for a long time. The first is make it easy. Sellers are, although they're very good at finance when, and they can calculate their commission check out to six decimal places, which, you know, coming, Tim, from exactly that, you know, that's the case working on commissions and incentives. Finance, when it comes to business cases for the customer, can be intimidating. And particularly when you give them a big spreadsheet, they, you know, even when you try to make it easy to use, it can still be intimidating. So what do we have to do? We have to keep it nice and simple. And then provide ways for the seller and the customer and you to peel the layers of the onion so that it becomes more thorough and credible for a CFO. But it doesn't start out that way. So I think helping the seller get to a value hypothesis with just a few data points, to me, is the best way to gain easy adoption. Make it more of a value discovery, value hypothesis tool that they use than a complex spreadsheet or a complex detailed ROI business case to create. And we found that that's the easiest way to make it a success. Then if the customer wants to drill in, that's where you bring in more of the value expert, more of, you know, pre-sales expertise, solution engineer expertise that can then take the customer to the next level. But try to keep it high level for the seller and the customer in the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, this resonates quite strongly with me. I've seen multiple ROI calculators over the past decade or so, and they vary in complexity. And in some cases, you have Excel sheets with like 5-10 different types of tabs, and you're wondering, okay, now I really would like to have a value-based quantitative discussion with my customer, but I have to fill out, 30 cells before I actually come to any sort of decent result. So I like that iterative process that you're suggesting here, and it draws a lot of parallels to our general way of working in pre-sales, I would argue, because also Jan and I, we are quite big proponents of the discovery process, right? And discovery is not something that you do once and then you're done. No, you engage multiple stakeholders, you learn more information, and it increases your knowledge over time and also gives you more direction of what to focus on, how to solve that particular prospect issues and going forward, fulfill their vision. The more you learn about it. And it's the same thing here, right? You're suggesting, okay, start with some few data points, learn more, and then go deeper and make it more accurate as you go.
Yeah. And I think aligning it with the use cases for the demos also makes this, as you said, to me, it's a discovery process. I use value discovery a lot. In fact, when we want a tool used by more sellers, we'll name it that in terms of, instead of a calculator or an assessment or an analysis. Because it is about this iterative discovery process and making it more formalized. I also think culturally at the company, there can be changes to improve the adoption. You know, if everyone focuses on value and you make it mandatory, where you know that customers need this, even though they're not asking for it, sellers have to be made aware that that is the case. And they need to be prompted so that, for example, a deal doesn't get to stage four unless it has a business case. That's a value hypothesis and a pro forma. And it doesn't get to stage five, maybe, unless you've got a formal business case that you've submitted that's ready for the CFO and ready for the COVID committee. So I think that there's a coaching and a management process in place. I think there's support that needs to be provided from pre-sales and value consulting. And then there's making it really easy and iterative for the seller to apply in the deal. And that's how we get and start chipping away at the 16% figure and get it up to 40, 50, 60% that we know it needs to be in the near term.
Yeah. So there's one other aspect that you slightly elaborated on a little bit, but I want to go a bit deeper here. So I don't know how you guys are doing it. Whenever I want to buy something for myself, just a consumer product, of course, I maybe go to the vendor's page and I look up the product and it tells me, hey, all of these great things there, why this product is, why I should buy it, right? Mm-hmm. But then I get very skeptical because there's a very inherent conflict of interest, right? Because the guy who's trying to sell me something is also the one arguing why I should buy it. So obviously, it's maybe not completely objective. What you just said makes a lot of sense to me. You say buying companies don't necessarily know how to build a business case for your particular solution. So we want to assist them with that. If I was now in the buyer's shoes, however, I would see that conflict of interest and take everything with a grain of salt. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I think that you can invite them into the collaborative process and so that they can see the model, you can see the model, they can customize it the way that they want. I think that that's important. So making sure it's a collaborative process is important. Even though you might be driving it, make it interactive and make it customizable. Make sure it's transparent so that there's no black box of, you know, the calculators I hate the most are you put in 2-3 numbers and you get out a magical ROI and you can't see where it came from. You can't adjust the values to your own personal needs. So black box, old-fashioned kind of ROI calculators don't work. So collaborative and interactive, transparency are key. And also, a lot of times, I'll show them where the crossing line is for this not making sense for them. So I'll actually promote that, you know, this can turn negative, and let's see where that is. You know, if you're only going to rely on this one use case and this one benefit, we're not going to get all the way there. You have to make sure you're implementing these other use cases. And I'll actually turn them off up to the point where it's the line is crossed and it comes out negative. So you show them that negative results are could occur and where that line is. And again, it's all about building trust. And when we talk about a buying decision, you know, even though I'm the ROI guy and I love numbers and I'm an engineer, as you mentioned, at heart, so I'm a systems thinker. And logic, to me, I pride myself on logical decision making. You know, logic maybe attributes to conscious decisions, maybe 25% of the decision-making process. And there are some that think it's less than 10%, some neuroscientists. Mm-hmm. Trust and emotion are a lot more of the decision-making process. So we need the logic, we need the business case, but it's also doing this work is a collaborative trust-building process with the customer. So the end result and the report that gets generated is important to take up to the CFO, to take up to the COVID committee and get them to approve it. They're taking a subjective, very logical view on the purchase. But when you're working with your stakeholders and your core team, there's a lot more emotion and trust that goes into it. And so you have to think of this not just as a, we're going to get to that end report. It's a process that you're walking the customer through, just like you walk them through and create a technical process so that they're, it's not just the facts and features of the product, that there's trust being built and there's emotion being built. It's the same on this business track. There's trust and emotion that you're amplifying and you're pressing the trust and emotion buttons throughout the process to make sure they're on board, not just the logical results of you're going to get 200% ROI off of the solution. That number by itself won't motivate them. There's a lot more that's involved. And so I view ROI as not just the number, but the process, collaborative and transparent process that you work with the customer on.
Yeah, and I think as part of that transparency, and at least this is something that I've observed working with the different ROI calculus that I've seen and worked with in the past, that there's always aspects in the calculation that my customers didn't even consider, right? Mm-hmm. There's maybe 2-3 aspects in there which do have not a negligible impact, definitely an impact to the ROI. Maybe it's not the main use case or not the main benefit, but there are certainly aspects to it where after a few thought exchanges, most customers would agree, oh yeah, you are right. This is a positive side effect that influences the calculation that we haven't even considered in the first place.
Yeah, and I think addressing those unmet challenges and showing them unrealized value within the organization, those are usually when you help a customer open up their frame and their perspective, that's where the light goes on. That's that emotional part, Tim. So you described it so well, where that's when you get them emotionally engaged and involved in a way that they weren't before. Like, wow, I can really achieve these other aspects. And that's why I like to think of value, not just as one dimension. A lot of times people think of value as, oh, how are we going to go and help that company save cost? Well, the first thing is to make sure that you've got benefits that are beyond just cost savings, right? There's the productivity process improvements, risk avoidance, and business growth to consider. But then you go beyond that and say, okay, how can this solution deliver personal value to the stakeholders? How could it help them maybe get a raise, get recognition, maybe stay or increase their relevance within the organization, right? How could it make them maybe improve work-life balance too? Then on the organizational value piece, which is the other end of the spectrum, how can it help to achieve a better employee experience by implementing the solution, a partner, better partner experience, better influencer experience, and then better customer experience? So we like to make sure that when we're putting together these business cases, that we can tell a story beyond just the dollars and cents, that we're hitting on the emotional and the trust buttons. And I'll get into how to do that in a moment with storytelling, but also making sure we've got a broad value perspective, not forgetting that there's a person. This is a person-to-person sale. So personal value is illuminated. And then there's an organizational value that can also be delivered to help elevate the organization, not just, again, save dollars and cents. I touched on storytelling a little bit, and I think, you know, we called our product Value Story for a reason, in that the dollars and cents themselves are there to just help you tell a story of the unique value that you can deliver. You have to make sure that story focuses on the emotional component and the trust component. So you wrap storytelling around it, and we call it close storytelling. challenge, loss, opportunity, solution, and evidence. And so you make sure you hit on the pain, you illuminate the gain, quantify the gain, and then you also make sure that you provide evidence that you can actually deliver on that. And you follow the storyteller's arc to make sure that any dollar figure you're claiming you can improve the organization by or save them, that a story accompanies that so that it gives context to anyone who reads it and picks it up.
So, I mean, I definitely appreciate what you just elaborated in terms of like how do humans internally work and how decision making works, right? This is what you're talking about, right? And logic is one piece of it, but it's actually not the biggest piece, but we can't ignore it. Hence why we do quantitative ROIs together. So now, if I put myself in the shoes of a CFO or a, as you called it multiple times now, like a COVID committee, right? And we have to do project prioritization. And maybe there's different factors that go into project prioritization and not really the topic for today, but surely one of those aspects would be what is the expected value to the organization if we go in with this project, project A versus project B. And maybe they even define a certain threshold. We will not even consider projects where the ROI, and I'm giving a random number now, that is lower than 300%.
Yeah. Right?
Maybe that's what they do. And I'm sure, I mean, I'm simplifying here. But one of the conversations that I had with salespeople, well, with colleagues basically, is what do you think is a minimum ROI that we need to present to this prospect in order for them to say, we have to do this project. There's no way around it. Mm-hmm. Is there a number that is like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's certainly, I don't want to have folks think there's a much more complex rubric that these decision committees go through. However, there is a financial threshold that needs to be crossed. It's usually multidimensional. And there are also emotional factors like how it's going to help them to achieve their biggest strategic goals. So don't forget that every business case, even though you want to have an ROI figure, you have to make sure it ties to those big goals. But let's get back to the heart of your question, which is, you know, what's the kind of minimum threshold? And how do we know what that is? You can ask the company, do you have, you know, what are the criteria that your CFO uses or your COVID committee uses to, and they're not calling them COVID committees internally, but the purchase committee, right? Uses to evaluate. And sometimes they'll share that with you. If you don't know that, you have to go back to decision science and look at what that entails. People don't change because of something called status quo bias. And status quo bias means that the reason why it's so difficult to get people to change, whether it's organizational change or a purchase decision, is because that our brains are designed to conserve energy. And we see any change as requiring a lot of energy. And also, in that process, we amplify the cost and the risk of change. And we often amplify the cost and risk of change by factors. And the factor that I've seen most cited is kind of a 2 to 3x factor. So think of the cost of your project, which is the investment that you're asking the company to make. And it's not just the spending on the license. It's all of the change cost internally, the training, all of that. So it's the total cost of implementing that solution as the investment. And then also think of an extra factor of risk. So they're going to scale that up with risk. So let's say a project is going to cost $1 million investment. It's a big project. And then there's probably some risk factors. So, you know, the company can assume usually there's like a 30% overrun in the cost or something like that. So all of a sudden now it's 1.3. Let's say they've got a pretty big risk factor. Let's say it's 1.5 million. They've risk adjusted the cost to be. Well, if we think of status quo bias in this decision-making process, we have to take that 1.5 million and say, look, to overcome that, the buyer needs to think they're getting not just the 1.5 million in benefits, but 2 times that, 3 times that, right? And so that's why you typically want to have an ROI in the order of 200 to 300% to account for this bias that we have, the status quo bias. So when you have your 1.5 million, that means that an ROI of 200% means that you're going to get $2 back above and beyond that original 1.5 that's there. So you get your 1.5 million back, and then you get 2 million in benefits. That's kind of the floor that I see we need to be working with today.
Yep.
One other factor in that, though, Tim and Young, that I want to point out is that, you know, people are in a very uncertain time nowadays. And with that, they're amplifying costs and risks, maybe even more, mm-hmm. right? So where you might have used 2x as the floor, now it's 3x, could even be 4x. What you don't want to have, though, is presenting a business case that's unrealistic. That's 8, 10x, right? So you don't want to have 1,000% return. You want to risk adjust that so it's reasonable. You don't maybe even want to have 800 would be the top end. So I think nowadays you kind of need to be in the 200 to 800% range as kind of the guardrails that I would put in place for reasonableness. But thinking about buyers in the mind state that they're in today, they are even more risk averse, even more cautious, and overloaded. So this concept of if we're able to streamline, and this is why Gartner and Challenger now are hitting on this, because buyers are so stressed, they're viewing choices as being very difficult to make. And overchoice is prevalent. The amount of information that gets thrown at a typical buyer and vendors, we're doing this, right? In the limited time we spend, we're throwing everything at them that we can, all the features, all the functions, all the collateral, like never before. If instead we take a step back and say, what do they need to make this purchase? What can we do to help clarify and help make them make the choice? Less is more. However, there are certain pieces that we need to provide, and the business case is definitely one of those pieces. So hope that folks are kind of getting that understanding that perspective that buyers have, and that they're overloaded and overchoiced, and however we can simplify their purchase decisions, all the better.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you talked not only about the threshold toward the minimum, but also to the maximum.
Yes.
Because I've seen those business cases where it's like 1,200%. I was like, guys,
I don't believe it. Yeah, where you're at now, Tim, where I'm at, you know, once you start impacting revenue and you can make a good case for impacting revenue, it's kind of easy to get those big business cases out there.
Yes.
You know, if you're just a solution that addresses one or two costs within the organization or improves productivity by a little bit, you're not going to have these blown up. But once you start saying, you know, we can really ramp up salespeople quicker and we can impact them and you can give more seller time back. And with that seller time, they can be optimized and selling more. You can get these overstated business cases. And the key there is risk adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
Risk adjust those down. Don't count all of the potential benefits. Show that the ideal impact you can have, but then you've got to risk adjust those cases so that there's an adoption curve that's implemented. And also there's a threshold where you might only count 10 cents on every dollar of potential revenue.
Yeah. And I think also what you just said earlier, right? When you want to increase the trustability, if that's a word, of your ROI, use more conservative values, right? The more conservative the values, the more believable they become. And if it's still in a compelling business case, then you're golden, right? That's
exactly.
That's where you want to be.
Yeah, be transparent and be conservative, definitely.
Yeah. So one of the biggest challenges, and this does not only relate to ROI, but in general sales engagements, but I would love to have your view on it, is in my view, engaging all the stakeholders that we really need to engage with in order to bring our prospect to a point where they can make a decision. Right? Mm-hmm. And as you rightfully elaborated earlier, quite often it begins with things like the department that is currently using maybe an Excel-based process, they want to now purchase software and they would like to see what is out there. And you go there, you do a demo, you do a pitch. So we want to bring in the value conversation, as you pointed out, even maybe to people that are only concerned around the actual impact to their daily business and the software they're going to use. We should still bring in that ROI conversation early in. But the challenge, and I'm coming to my point now, the challenge now that I see often is it's quite difficult to now find these additional stakeholders that really care about the quantitative perspective of the value that you can bring and are part of the decision-making process. How do we engage these additional stakeholders if we're just speaking to the guys that are going to use the software?
Yeah, so it's a great question, because when we look at the research and we think about how many stakeholders are involved in a decision, corporate executive board and the Challenger folks used to say, 5.6, and then that grew to 7. Well, the latest research out of Gartner looks at both direct and indirect influencers on a purchase decision. The numbers are startling. 14 to 23 people involved in a decision, both directly and indirectly. And many of those, you don't even know who they are within the organization, yet they've got veto power in a lot of instances. They can make the decision and you don't even know that they were involved. So there's a lot more decision makers involved in every purchase, and that's not going down with uncertain times. That's only gone up. COVID committee, CF no, et cetera.
Right.
And executives, by the way, clip levels are down to 50K for CEO and CFO sign-off on average in organizations. We're not just talking small organizations. We're talking some rather big organizations where the CEO now is signing off on 50K purchase orders. And you're trying to get $1 million purchase across. You can imagine the hurdles. So the hurdles are high. How do you make sure that you're getting out of the comfort zone people that you're working with and building a business case for everyone is important. A lot of times sellers will be engaged at that tactical level. Mm-hmm. If you're selling a solution to IT, maybe they're only talking to the system administrator or the security manager within the organization. They're not even talking to the CIO, much less the business users within the organization, much less the CFO and the CEO, who ultimately care about making sure the organization is secure. So how do you do that? Well, you make sure that you've got benefits that relate to different stakeholders. You make sure that you are collecting information from your sellers so that when you ask who are the roles you're engaging with, you're actually prompting them with additional roles they may want to engage with within the organization. And the buyer actually is seeing the roles that you think should be involved. So I think everything has to start when you're building a value model and these things foundationally, the messaging and the value quantification, you have to think of who are the roles that are involved in the decision. You need to then make sure you've got the right storytelling and the right quantification so that you've got benefits that map to each one of those roles, and you've done that mapping. And then you're prompting the seller and the customer that they are working with to actually indicate who are the roles that are involved. And then you're turning on those benefits that relate to those roles so that when they do have the case developed, there are benefits that will appeal to the business unit, even though it's a security solution, or the CFO, and CEO, even though it's a security solution. So making sure you've got productivity benefits so that security is implemented, but it doesn't get in the way, or you've got CEO and CFO regulatory and compliance issues that are being highlighted instead of just total cost of ownership savings on the security solution and, general risk avoidance. So you make sure you're mapping everything to stakeholders right from the start, or going back and doing that mapping, making sure you've got benefits and business value that covers all of the different stakeholders, because every stakeholder has a different point of value instead of point of view. And you've got a tool that helps really amplify the stakeholders that should be engaged and has value mapped to them so that it will produce the value automatically for those stakeholders, because they will see the business case and will likely have to sign off on it.
Mm-hmm. So now, I'm thinking about this very tactically right now, right? I'm envisioning myself, I'm in the sales meeting and there's potentially like a user buyer and we're doing the pitch, we're doing the demo. And then I'm starting to open up around the value that we can bring. And now I would have to consciously put things into my messaging, which I know will not be of 100% relevance to this particular person, but I want to use that to convince the person that I am having the conversation with that I would love to speak to the colleagues of his and her to engage on those points, which I've basically brought with into the meeting, even though it's not 100% for them.
So how do I do it? Right on the first page, we usually put who are the roles that are going to be involved in this decision-making process. And they may say, oh, well, my role is IT. Great. Click IT. And then I'd say, you know, there's other roles listed here because we can deliver, you know, these other roles have security challenges and we could deliver value to them. Let's turn them on as well. And maybe we can work them into the discussion later. And then there are challenges that relate to each one of those roles that we can help to solve that we're going to want to begin educating those user buyers on. But it is an iterative process because you have to first address the personal value and the business value and the organizational value that those key user group will want you to address. But then you do need to expand beyond that because these 14 to 23 other folks are going to be involved and you may only be talking to three of them.
Yeah. All right. So I do have one final question for you. But before I ask that question, I'm looking towards Jan, who has been quiet, which is fine. But maybe he has one or two things on his mind before I finish off with my closing question.
It's just lovely listening. I really enjoyed listening to your podcast. So
thank you, Jan.
Great one. I mean, I'm not sure, Tim, what is your final question, but what I really like is, Tom, that you really combining a lot of different areas, which when it comes to ROI, right? So initially, maybe people think about, yeah, that's a numbers game, but there is so much more involved. And I think it's totally in line with what I have in mind when it comes to value-based selling and put your customer first, put your customer in the center and be a helper, right? You also used helper as a word. So I really like that. And I have even seen in very small engagements where pre-sales people had an Excel sheet, just an Excel sheet, right? But initiated that discussion with the prospect or the potential customer proactively, really led them to a great deal, right? Because as you said, so people maybe are not asking for it. They would need it at some point. They are not able to build it on their own. And we shouldn't have any fear to bring it up, right? Because, I mean, maybe worst case is like, okay, we don't see an ROI at all. But that's, I guess, also a good thing because we can save a lot of time, right? We don't need to do custom demo POCs or whatever. And I would say we still build trust, right? And the next time when that customer runs into another issue, they would call us again because we would have built a lot of, positive report, I believe. And this is what I like. And I mean, the number you mentioned is shocking to me. So 16%, definitely not enough, right? Because it could add so much value to us, but especially to our customer. So this is what I really kind of take away from today's episode. Presented by Tim Brunner.
and my final question does relate specifically what you finished off with, Jan, right? The 16%, and I think, Tom, you phrased it in a way where you said only 16% of the sellers know how to do a good value-based engagement or a good business ROI conversation. So that means that the other, 84%, obviously doing maybe something, maybe they're doing it, but maybe they're doing it wrong, or maybe they don't have the right timing, or whatever it may be, one of the things that we discussed here already in this conversation. But if there was one thing that you would give to those 84% of the people who are not doing it to the optimum, what would it be? What is the one tip where you would say this is where you have leverage?
Yeah, and that opinion, by the way, is not my opinion. That was the feedback directly from the buyers saying there's that gap, right? So that is a buyer gap. 84%, what is the advice I would give them? I think in most cases, it's just not being done. So my advice is just get started with a nice, simple value hypothesis, value estimate, a pro forma. Collect a little bit of data from the customer. Hopefully you're armed with the tool. Don't be afraid of that tool. Dive in and use it. But provide a simple analysis back to the customer and get started small and then use that as the jumping point. Many customers today I'm seeing are just leveraging those value hypotheses and giving it to the buying group and getting approved. So you don't have to make this a science project. You don't have to think about it delaying. And I think there's this opinion out there that this will delay the decision. It is required. So I think the bottom line advice I've got is you've got to deliver this on every deal. Do it proactively, do it simply, and that's the place to start. And just like any other journey that you're going to take to grow or that you're going to take to improve, it starts with one step, and the one step is just do it.
Perfect. Perfect last words to conclude the conversation. Thank you very much, Tom. So yeah, really a pleasure having you here, and thank you for the collaboration. To the listeners, Tom, Jan and myself, we already had a conversation with him on his podcast, so we can very much encourage you to also tune into that one. Tom, if it's all right with you, we would of course put your LinkedIn profile into the show notes so the potential listener can look you up in case there's maybe follow-up questions or comments on anything that we've talked about here today. But with that said, thank you so much, Tom. Dear listener, if you liked what you heard here today, please do us a favor, follow us on LinkedIn. This gives us some insight into how many people are listening and how you like our content here, because you can directly provide feedback there. And of course, we would love for you to give us a rating on Apple Podcast, because that's still the go-to place for podcast ratings. So with that being said, thanks for tuning in. And last words to you, Jan.
Thanks, Tom. You have been an amazing guest. And thanks, Tim. You run a great podcast. See you next time.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.